Thus we see the gradual dedication to the tremendous expressions of creative genius. We find the same refinements taking place on the emotional level when the Kama-rupa begins to be regenerated and one produces essentially the artist or ultimately the mystic, and the other, the mental, produces essentially the sage or the philosopher, and ultimately through this process and through the union of the two, the philosopher and the mystic, accomplishes the possibility of the apperception of total reality. But this apperception is not either of mind or emotion, but goes beyond them. But they build toward it. And in the gradual development of man, we see that the upper developments of the mind move towards the unselfish universal service of common good, the instruction of mankind, the disciplining and natural control of the personality itself, and a richly increasing and deepening appreciation of what constitutes essential value. All these things tell us that the being is using the higher phases of its vehicles. Now, in the life cycle, after the entity, having passed out of incarnation, passes through the two spheres of the kamic world, namely Kamaloka or Purgatory, and Devachan or the Paradiso, it then ascends into the substance of its mental nature, which becomes the highest and final of its individual vehicles of expression. At this time, the emotional or astral body is cast off. It is cast off after the records or the essential nature of the achievement has been incorporated into the superior vehicles. Having thus passed into the state of a mental existence, the entity is then polarized according to the degree of unfoldment that has been attained, particularly first by the Kama-rupa in the preceding embodiment. The desire mind, or the mind of desire, is its first introduction to a mental existence after death. Now, the mental existence differs from the Kamalokic different in this difference, that whereas in Kamaloka punishments and rewards are in terms of feelings, in the mental body punishments and rewards are in the terms of rationality. In other words, here the individual lives in a world of thoughts. Therefore, this world, as described to us in the vision of Aridius and others, is no longer a world of wonderful houses and trees and mountains and fountains and all these things associated with the summer land of Andrew Jackson Davis. In the mental level, the individual has the experience that we sometimes hear a very exceptional person describe, when he says he had a beautiful evening with his own thoughts. That's a hard thing to do, by the way, because in most cases our thoughts won't support such a delightful experience. Usually our thoughts get a little out of hand, they are morbid and melancholy, full of regrets and memories. And here's the rub. The lower level, or Kamarupic plane of the mind, is the zone of intellectual memory. And here, the individual has to have the experience of remembering. Now, memories are nice things when you can filter them out with your emotions and various screens and only remember exactly what you want to. Or perhaps memories can be very nasty things when you have very carefully filtered out all the good ones.
You can do it either way. But in the after-death experience on the lower levels of the mental nature, the memories are just plain honest, which can be the most embarrassing of all. Here, when you remember what horrible things other people did to you, you also remember with beautiful clarity exactly the nasty things you did to them. It's not comforting, but oh, so educational. On the plane of the mind, therefore, we examine all things, concrete mental on the level of fact, abstract mental on the level of reality. Now, it may possibly be that we were not distinguished during life for mentation, and therefore, our mental existence is not a particularly complete one. We sometimes say that we are sure that many people have only had three or four thoughts in a lifetime and did very little about those. Remember, exercise in youth strengthens bodies, whether they are visible or invisible. And if the mental life of the individual is inadequate, his mental existence in the mental body is correspondingly brief and inadequate. It would naturally then be assumed that the after-death mental state of the comparatively primitive human being would be shorter than that of the civilized man that is. And barring the circumstances which do arise, in which very highly evolved minds that have attained to the full height of reason may voluntarily return simply in service of their fellow men, we may say that what we would term today the great illumined teacher would have so vast an after-death mental existence that it would be a great time before, in the cycle of evolution, he would normally return to embodiment. Thus, a Bushman or a Digger Indian might be back in a year or two from the mental level. But, of course, he would be longer on the Devachanic or Kamalokic planes. He would have a long emotional existence, perhaps, but not as long as that of the mature emotional being who has had a great deal of intensity in living, because the primitive person lives in a great acceptance and therefore does not stimulate either emotional or mental conflict. But presuming then that the life of the aborigine on the mental plane would be mostly the contemplation of observation, an integration of things seen in daily living, about which only the most rudimentary reflection existed. In the case of a man like Plato, this exhaustion of the mental world might require in the normal course of time 10,000 earth years. This is due to the tremendous amount of internal mental life that is stored up, and also the fact that the after-death purpose is not new experience, but the incorporation of experience into the consciousness of the person, of the being. Let us, for instance, say, just as a simple example of this, that you are reading the Holy Scripture, and you are simply a good and devout believer. So you read a parable, and you interpret it to yourself as you would interpret it to your child, a fine ethical message. And that exhausts it. But if you, at that time of your study, happen to be one of the old sages of Israel, for example, one of the great assembly of the old Sanhedrin, your first realization would be that this parable has 72 meanings. Every line, word of Scripture, according to them, at 6 times 12 interpretations. That every letter and every word of that parable, by notarikon and gematria, could be exchanged and reversed. The text could be rebuilt and rewritten 100, 500, 1,000 ways. And therefore, that gradually, out of the one text, you could evolve a work perhaps running into more pages than the entire Bible. you can realize that the amount of thought, the amount of contemplation, the amount of time required for the digestion of that which by reminiscence is brought to the awareness out of the self by the text would depend upon your scholarship. The more you know, the more you are, the more everything means to you. Thus, an individual who, like we will say again for our purposes, Plato, who reached the philosophic age, who had attained a long and useful life, coming to the 81st year, in that lifetime experienced many times more than we experience, because every event was more meaningful and also more instructive. He probably knew more of his mistakes than we could possibly know of ours. And so gradually, the reorganization, the extraction of the total meaning of every thought, every word, every decision, every contact, every relationship, in terms of essential wisdom, would be a very difficult and different problem from that which we would face. And because of that, these periods of assimilation differ according to the qualities and attributes of the person. Obviously, also, a mind like Plato, or perhaps even Aristotle, though to a somewhat lesser degree, because his mind was very much more on the fourth level of pure intellect. This departmentizing of mind, the mind of a Pythagoras, ascending through consciousness, he was aware of the universal harmony of the spheres. A mind of that caliber would have its greatest extension of conscious existence in the higher levels of the mental plane. Whereas perhaps a very wonderful statistician, an individual who had a very skillful and clever intellect, sharply used, highly trained, but not creative, would have a greater endurance and a greater period of existence on the level of concrete mind, the lower plane. Now, in mind, we no longer have the problem that we had in the Devachanic planes, namely heaven and hell. We no longer have reward and suffering. There is no longer acute pain because the mind does not suffer as the emotions do. The mind accepts, analyzes, and passes through the simple and severe state of being right or wrong. It is no longer a matter of regret, because if it's regret, it goes right back to the emotional again. The mind is educated or unfolded, seeing that which is so and that which is not so. Thus, punishment on the mental level is the recognition of the error of judgment. It is the realization that the thought was incorrect. Reward, on the same level, is the recognition of the essential validity of the position taken by the mind. And gradually, through the reorganization of context by the memory faculty, which is located in the cerebellum and is isolated from the other parts of the brain, through the memory faculty, the individual has available to him the complete text. He has it in a way that we cannot have it in our daily living, because we are not sufficiently acute in our thinking. But through the complete text, the mind has available complete context. That is, the inevitable relationships between cause and effect, the consequences of an effect, the inevitable outcome of decision, the continuous sequences by which we become aware of the ultimate consequence of any given action. These things, by review, perfect the mind in its accuracies and in its judgments. And on the level of fact, the lower part of the mental plane, the mind is led to factuality, the ability to conquer opinion and to arrive at judgment. The higher level carries the mind power and the mind process to realization of reality, or to the higher degree of reason. Here the mind becomes indoctrinated or aware of the validity of the reasonable over the factual. That things which are reasonable may be more true than those things which are factual. That things factual may be unreasonable. And that things reasonable may be unfactual. This is something that we cannot judge from our perspective. But the mind extending itself towards the superior moves more and more into the creative sphere of pure reason. And as it does so, it is enriched by an attribute that we do not suspect. The one thing that we often associate with the mind and by which we depreciate it is the idea that it's supposed to be a very cold, calculating, heartless, feelingless instrument, largely given to the process of making other people uncomfortable with unrequested advice. Actually, in its higher creative aspects, the mind is not cold. Reason is not dull, dry, colorless. In its own and essential nature, reason is ascending gradually to a state superior to itself. It is moving just as nearly all great scholars, great philosophers have moved towards something superior to that which was originally understood, either historically or symbolically, depending on how we want to look at it and how much we want to trust the ancient writers, especially Xenophon. It would seem that the life of Plato was created to express this ascent. Because, as you will remember, he began life with an avowed desire to be a politician. He was convinced that what Athens needed was good government, and he was ready to get out and stump for it. He started and he went along for a while, and then he came to the conclusion that good government was impossible unless there were good people to run it. And that while the governed and the governing were both selfish and ignorant, good government could not be attained. So he departed from politics and became a philosopher. And he set up his school, the Academy, for the purpose of training men in governing themselves, on the grounds that no one who could not govern himself could govern anybody else. You see what we have accomplished now? We have moved from the Kamarupa, here the concept of good government, or the emotional desire to improve men in spite of themselves, and have Plato now moving to the middle zone of individuality, for the purpose of teaching them how to govern and understand themselves, which is the peculiar purpose of the focal point of individuality. Here he remained for a number of years. And here, of course, during this period, he came in contact with Aristotle, and the two were friends for many years, but finally separated when Plato went into the third cycle of his life. When in the last 10 or 15 years of his physical existence, he turned away from teaching as he had previously taught and moved from philosophy to theology. He became concerned primarily with the aspects of higher mysticism. and it was here that Aristotle could not follow him. For Plato discovered, as he himself tells us in his writings, that the contemplations of pure reason had drawn him inevitably toward the adoration of the fountain of reason, that through his gradual ability to honestly estimate life, either human or universal, he had come inevitably to the recognition of the great sovereign principle from which all life descended. Through reason, he had come to a rational contemplation of the divine. Now, he couldn't have done it on the mental level had he not passed through philosophy. If he had done it on the emotional level, he would have passed through the ecstasy or sublimation of mysticism. But on the philosophical level, he became a great rational mystic. For he began to contemplate the entire world of knowledge as existing for only one purpose, that through it was revealed the workings of the one which is eternal. Thus reason became only the handmaiden of truth. And beyond the mind and all that it could engender was the infinite being, the substance of all things, the end of all seeking. Now we do not know that Plato achieved what Plotinus did through his mystical union. But we do know that he did attain that purpose which fulfills or culminates the career of mind. He reached that point in which he stood on the mountain and looked forth into the promised land. He had made the long and dangerous journey. He had passed through the dark night of the soul. And he had come to the point where wisdom had revealed to him the absolute certainty of truth. Now, when wisdom has accomplished this, the mind has fulfilled itself. The mind can do no more. It can never do any more. Therefore, the mind must gradually sublimate. Now, with man, the mind cannot sublimate at this time in his cycle of evolution and still permit him to have a conscious existence. Because at this time, his individuality as a being is located in the middle zone of the mental nature. Therefore, when he has exhausted his own mental life, whatever that may be, he then must pass into sleep. Because if he casts off this body, he has no vehicle of manifestation remaining. So when the mental essences of experience, reflection, meditation, are transferred into the egoic vortex, it means that the skandhas have delivered all of their testimonies back into the sattva or ego. And there it remains like the famous Ark of Noah, floating over the deep, carrying within itself the seeds and principles of many lives to come. Thus the entity or the being, having achieved its purpose, retires to sleep. The mental body is cast off, having exhausted its potential. And beyond this, the individual must rest or sleep until the new vehicles of manifestation are objectified. So having exhausted the complete totality of mind, the individual is in possession of something else. The records of each body are transferred according to a sequence of superiority to the superior bodies in each case. Therefore, when the mental body reaches the totality of its manifestations and has drawn back into itself the sutratmas, or seeds, of the other bodies, the mental body then possesses the power of rationalizing the total pattern of the life cycle that it has experienced. It may gaze down, so to say, or outward, into the fields of desire, energy, and form, and unite all of their testimonies by judgment. It therefore is in the position, perhaps, to accomplish certain things. One is to have a fair picture of total success and failure, or the degree of achievement that has been attained, as against the degree of achievement yet to be attained. It also is then empowered, because of its virtue, because of its integration, to decide to some degree, according to its maturity, those parts of the problems of growth which it wishes to next assume. Thus being in a position, if it has reached a certain degree of individuality, of determining certain incidents, or grand patterns, or broad purposes of future embodiments. Having thus achieved this orientation, the mind relinquishes its hold and goes to sleep. The mental body does not die as we know it. It simply fades out, disintegrates by the process of exhausting the energies which it contains, or else exhausting the conscious experiences which can be rescued from it. When there is nothing left in it, then it is finished. It no longer can stimulate activity. And the individual passes into quiescence, awaiting future embodiment. In the Buddhistic doctrine, we then find this problem of the bridge, which extends above the individuality, which is the focus of selfhood, and extends up into the Buddhic manasic field, which is the field of the enlightened mind. In Buddhism, manifestation above the level of individuality can only occur to the degree that individuality itself is reduced. The self being the focal point of the axis of the wheel of rebirth. Rebirth is a cycle from the self to the self, and cannot be broken while it begins and ends in the self. The Buddhic, therefore, or the higher phases of mind, are reflections of what might be termed the overtones, or selfless reason. Now, what is selfless reason? It's a hard word to think about, even let alone define. We're not any of us awfully good at it, you know, and it's not something with which we have much experience. We have a certain sense of it, however, in certain occasions, when we say that an individual is absorbed in an idea. We have occasions, even on our objective life, in which we think without knowing that we think, and that we have thoughts without these thoughts being directly associated to ourselves. They are rare, and they are not as common as we think, because nearly always when we break thoughts down, we do find a little selfish, subtle something in there that is tied to self. But it is conceivable that it is possible for the person to think a selfless thought. This would mean that he is using the mind above the level of the sattvic focus. Now, if after death he has built these superior strata of the mental body to any appreciable degree, he cannot function in them on a sattvic level, that is, when the self goes to sleep, which it does with a loss of individuality. Then the overtones are experienced by this being, the sattva. as a kind of overtone of dream in the sleep of death. And in this sleep of death, what dreams shall come? The sattva going to sleep at the end of the mental life may be capable, under certain conditions, of an apperceptive experience above its own selfhood. This is the beginning of a new body and a new quality function. At this time, it is still on the mental level, because it is still like a psychological experience in relation to man's objective nature. Although he may psychologically have a vision of being in heaven, he is not there. He is functioning psychologically on a level of apperception within himself, but it is within him. The same is true if, on the mental level, the individual has an extension into what is called buddhic experience. This buddhic experience is an overtone of inspiration, a powerful development of what we call the intuitive faculty, but intuitive in the sense of an overtone of thought, not a completely pure intuition. So that if the individual has developed, as we might say a person like Pythagoras might have developed, a tremendous abstract intuitive apperception of divine things, rationally conceived, but at the same time essentially valid. In other words, if this intuitive apperception is true, then the individual has the possibility of a dreamlike extension of himself into a state superior to selfhood. And by so doing, to become aware of or conscious with the universal principle of manas, or universal mind. For we must realize that the seventh or highest level of each body is its link with the universal substance of which that body is composed. Thus, the seventh level upward of the emotional body is its link with the pure substance of universal love. The seventh or highest link of the mental body is its contact with the pure substance of universal mind. Thus we have references to universal mind, to the possibility of man experiencing it. It is still mind, but man may extend, under certain conditions, into higher levels of mind than the level upon which the ego is integrated. But this is man outreaching himself upward. It is a position which he cannot maintain consistently because it is unnatural to him. It's like trying to be better than you are all the time. It simply won't hold up. You can have big moments, but if you do, you're going to have some weak ones soon after. So this problem is too abstract to maintain, but the individual may have apperceptive awareness of it, just as he may have objectively intuitional apperception of states of being or consciousness superior to himself. All growth, of course, is through arcs of apperception. And the individual who has just finished the addition in school has already had an arc of apperception toward multiplication and has a hunch about what it is going to be like. Thus, he is able to bridge across because he has built an arc of apperception. A man in his mental life reaching toward that which is beyond mind creates these arcs which give him a certain subtle awareness of what is to follow. This gives us then the introduction to the link of between manas as intellect and buddhi as the principle of pure universal illumination, which is not intellect, but is beyond intellect and corresponds with the positive pole of the world soul. Now, the problem relating to that will be gone into in the next discussion, but we want to get down now to a few more or less relevant details tying some of these ideas to more familiar subjects. If we realize, then, that the mind, the mental body, can never be perceived objectively except in its pattern of sequence with the emotional and vital bodies, and that these flow outward through the physical centers of distribution to become our objective selves, then if we look at man inwardly at any time, we will see the mind only through the vital principle, which is one veil before it, and the emotional principle, which is another vestment upon it. Thus, in any moment when we examine man, we can perfectly well assume that his transcendental nature consists of a mind-emotion unity. Just as we look into the heavens and we see what are called twin stars, and we call them that because they are so close together, when actually they are billions of miles apart. Thus, because of our inability to estimate qualitative interval, we cannot realize that things in juxtaposition are not necessarily close together. The mind, then, when examined psychologically, is assumed to be in constant and immediate sympathy or relationship with the emotions, and both tied together into a pattern. Actually, the so-called psychological diseases of the mind are due to ignorance, and those of the emotions to excess, and they are not the same thing. Yet ignorance may lead to excess, and excess may sustain ignorance. And in the study of a case history, it is not always simple to distinguish these elements or these factors. The growth of man, psychologically considered, must therefore always be a recognition that a different therapy is required for the emotions than is required for the mind, and that there is nothing more fatal than to throw these two into mutual conflict in the hope of neutralizing a difficult situation. And that is a very, very common thing to do. One of the simplest expressions of such conflict is to tell the individual who is under emotional stress that he should think it out. He can think forever, he will not solve it. Or to tell someone who is under heavy mental stress that what he should do is go out and enjoy himself. There are a number of other incorrect diagnoses that arise from this particular type of thing. One is the belief, for example, that if you let your feelings go, the mind will relax. Or if you think good, solid thoughts, your emotions will collapse under the pressure of them and become nicely disciplined and inhibited little creatures. The only way the mind can control the emotions actually by control is through tyranny of some kind, autocracy, or through the energy of the will, which is the basis of it. The mind can say, don't do it, like a parent who is a little exasperated with a small boy. Maybe the boy will stop and maybe he won't, but his virtues do not necessarily multiply even if he stops. He may be merely biding his time for a better opportunity. We also know that the idea of trying to rescue the mind simply by the stimulation of emotional impulse will not solve the matter either. We cannot play the two against each other. And that is one of the reasons why a good many systems of psychotherapy are not more successful. What we have to do is recognize the inalienable rights of both, and to realize that normalcy or equilibrium is bringing these two onto sympathetic levels of common function. You can never be so wise that your wisdom will take the place of emotional balance. And you can never be so magnificently emotionally balanced that it will cure ignorance. Each of these things has to be solved on its own level. The problem of creating a partnership or of arbitrating differences and recognizing the importance of rendering unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, etc., is the only solution. The psychotic problems of mankind stem from two sources, mental and emotional. And these may be compounded to create emotional-mental or mental-emotional difficulties. But primarily, in almost every instance, the dynamic cause is one of these two, and the other is a subordinate or secondary contributing cause. It is very rare that the mind and the emotions are equally guilty in any particular situation, because there is no particular situation in nature in which both have equal authority. In every situation, one or the other has priority. Therefore, the priority determines the basic cause. If the cause is mental, then it is necessary that the material problem be handled, not by bringing the emotions blindly and crudely, like some rough chemical formula out of the pharmacopoeia, which treated one ailment with a certain medication and no other, but to recognize that normalcy must be established on both of these levels, and that their final union must be voluntary, and that their cooperation must be mutual, or else the union will never be productive. We find this even in the animal kingdom, where forced mating is usually a failure. There must be the voluntary cooperation of the two factors in order to produce the integration, which is almost the child of the mind and heart. If these two are not brought into proper order, then they will not function. Emotions mature through release under suitable conditions. The mind matures by direction, under suitable incentives. And where these two necessary elements are provided, the remedies become permanent. Whereas otherwise, symptoms may be temporarily cleared away, but because the causes are not removed, the individual simply falls into another problem. If, for example, his mind is not strong enough to correct his emotional excesses and integrate them on the level of understanding, any emotional excess for which a remedy is found will only give rise to another, because the individual cannot protect the state of normalcy. He doesn't know how. If, on the other hand, the mental nature is inadequate, the emotions made through stimulation try to supply or supplement the deficiency, but they cannot do so. And no amount of sincerity in all the world can prevent the inadequate mind from getting itself and others into trouble. This is the grand story of personal affection. We may love profoundly, but if we do not love wisely, very little is accomplished. So everywhere in these problems there is a partnership, which must be voluntary. Neither the emotions nor the mind can attain a state of health independent of each other. Yet neither can save the other, because each, strangely enough, must save itself. But in saving itself, it becomes the guide and protector of the other on a basis of mutual security. The emotions are referred to and have been referred to as being the source of the soul. And here again we have had some problem, because in psychology the soul is regarded as both mental and emotional. But in the Eastern system, the soul actually represents not the total psychic life of man as in Western thinking, but essentially the emotion quotient, which is consummated and summated in the concept of the universal love of God. In other words, the soul represents the heart of God in the meaning of the great psychic sensitivity of deity to the need of its creation. The mind represents the intellect of deity and the archetypal plan which is created and sustained by reason in the divine mind. Therefore, actually, the mind represents the dispensation of law, and the heart the dispensation of grace. Now, grace and law have been turned against each other more than once. But actually, grace tells us that through complete love, man discovers the perfection of the law. Loving deity for the lawfulness of God. For the law is not only the great good, but the greatest kindness, the greatest beauty, for justice, integrity, and reason are the most kindly of all things, because they alone are truthful. In the same way, the law discovers the mystery of grace, and grace is the natural fulfillment of the law. For the law, accomplishing all things through wisdom, accomplishes them in beauty, and discovers through the evolution of man, who is the embodiment of law, that all the processes of the universe are revealed through beauty, and therefore that beauty is the symbol of the perfect good, even as law is the emblem of the eternal one. The one and the good and the beautiful are likewise one. Now, in the psychological life of man, these things are also true. As the mind rules in the sphere of reason or of law, and the heart in the sphere of mercy or of grace, surely these two work together. They are necessary, but they are not the same. They represent a pair of perceptive powers by means of which man accomplishes a stereoscopic consciousness toward life. Thus, in ancient times, they were assigned to the right and left eye. For by these two eyes, man becomes aware of himself and nature. But the eyes are not one. But through their union of vision is achieved what cannot be accomplished by either alone. And through the heart and mind and the vehicles for which they represent, or which they represent, man is able to attain a perspective relating to himself and nature and the causal universe from which he is suspended. Now, there are a great many things to talk about, but I think we've done enough for this evening.